Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing again? Thank you so much for joining me at Hack the Entrepreneur. I truly, truly appreciate it. My name is John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. We are back with part two of our very first co-founders series. Today's guest is also co-founder of Enterprise Jungle, along with Emma Sinclair, who we featured in the last episode. He started young and had some early exits, which led to a number of advisory roles with emerging companies seeking to accelerate growth. He has an absolute willingness to fail. He thinks you should always have a side gig, and he has an unbelievable amount of respect for his co-founder. I can tell you from speaking to him today that this guy knows how to grow a business. Now, let's hack James Sinclair. I want to thank today's awesome sponsor, FreshBooks, not only for sponsoring Hack the Entrepreneur, but also for personally helping me fix one of my biggest problems. I am absolutely terrible at staying on top of my bookkeeping and accounting for my business. Now, rather than losing receipts and handing my accountant a giant box of papers at the end of the year, FreshBooks has an amazing app for my phone that lets me instantly take pictures of my receipts and sort them with the touch of a single button. FreshBooks is designed for small business owners and is the number one cloud accounting solution that helps millions of entrepreneurs and small business owners to save time and get paid faster. FreshBooks integrates directly with three things that I use every day in my business: PayPal, Stripe, and MailChimp. To start your 30-day free trial today, go to freshbooks.com/hack. And don't forget to enter Hack the Entrepreneur in the How Did You Hear About Us section. All right, we are back to Hack the Entrepreneur, and we have another amazing guest today. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
Let's jump right into it, James. As an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes this far?
Oh, the one? So the trouble with talking about the one is that it never is one. Success is a culmination of a lot of different tracks, a lot of different paths you take, and a lot of things you do. And success is about, you know, putting yourself in the right place to take advantage of opportunity and having the knowledge to understand when opportunity presents itself. And so I think if I had to say my top one, I'd probably say it's always having a side gig. It's always working on side projects, whether that's mentoring other startups, whether that's charity, whether that's doing some consulting for a large company. Having that quest to always be expanding network, expanding knowledge, always be challenged, not only provides more opportunity and more insight and more knowledge, lets me consistently re-understand how I view things, but also leads to all these other opportunities that come from it. So I think all of those things, you know, that come from having this side gig kind of push us forward, you know, and it achieves this thirst for knowledge and the need to always move forward. And also the need to never be, you know, not bored per se with your own startup, but it's very easy in your own startup to kind of be in a fishbowl. And it's really important to get outside that fishbowl and look at it from a different angle and to hear what other people have to say. So my answer to that Jeopardy question is side gig.
I like it. I like it. And I was wondering if I was doing the wrong thing because I had a slight lull for a few weeks over the summer in my business, I guess the startup we're trying to do. And I kind of just like, oh, I need to do something. So I started a podcast that kind of now has taken off. And then I'm like, oh, I got two giant things I have to like juggle. But you're right. I mean, I kind of needed that. But it's interesting because we had your sister, your co-founder on, and you guys are doing Enterprise Jungle, which is a massive scale of a project. It's big. It's really big. So that being said, what is your current side gig besides that?
So I think I have a few side gigs. One is being a father and husband. Right. And I think it's important to recognize that one. And people always talk about the complexities and difficulties of being a startup and what that does and the impact it has on relationships and the need to separate work and life. You know, for me, I'm passionate about my work and I'm passionate about my life. So I don't see this clear separation between the two. But I do recognize the time I spend there. My second is I spend as much time as possible mentoring other people who are walking down a road that I've traveled, perhaps, and I can provide them insight into areas to mitigate their risk, perhaps, or, you know, get to failure or success quicker. And so I think that part of the mentoring process is kind of what we learn from that process and what we learn from these startups. You're speaking to incredible people who are doing incredible things. And so it's a great opportunity to get your mind clicking. And then finally, every now and again, one gets lucky and, you know, a company phones and says, hey, we know you have this domain expertise. Do you want to come in and talk to us about it? At which point you get to not only make money, but you get to, again, expand your network and learn and talk about what you do best and all the other opportunities that come from that.
Excellent. And I like that. And now you've been in business for, I mean, a fair bit of time, I think, from what I know. And you've already had some exits from companies and you've worked in and within some big companies within tech. So could you just maybe take us back? Because I find that there's a time in every entrepreneur's life when they realize that one of two things, either they have a calling to go make big things or they just can't work for someone else. So could you tell me maybe which one of those two you are and then how and when that sort of happened for you?
So I think I've always worked for someone else, but just I'm not a very good employee per se. In terms of there's always someone that has to write the check coming towards me or towards our company. And I think for me, it was recognizing that I'm best served when I can be free to question and push and explore. And it's not so much that that made me a bad employee. It's that it didn't fit into the general protocols or guidelines of an employee position. You know, I have a need to get things done, a need to move forward, and I don't have much patience, or I'm pretty stubborn about my beliefs. And so I realized that the only way to be able to achieve success for myself was to be in a position to get something done and to take it the whole way and to be able to maintain that control of wanting to see success. And so I think that's come for basically most of my life. I've had that. You know, I started very early working for some large tech companies and I recognized the hurdles out there and what I enjoyed and what I didn't enjoy. I certainly enjoyed working in a large company and the security and the stability it brings. But I didn't enjoy the speed of business and the speed of innovation and the speed of getting things done. I think when you think about a lot of people at large businesses, they suffer from that same desire or that same thirst for wanting to see success. And so for me, it came to, finding these challenges and starting my own businesses or consulting. And both of those meet those guidelines for me. But it doesn't mean I'm a bad employee per se. It just means I'm better as a consultant and I'm better as someone that can sit on the sidelines and give you my true thoughts and give you my opinions. And I want companies or the people I work for to be willing to fail and be willing to take a risk and take a leap. And when you're so focused on your performance and bonus and stability and security, one is naturally unable to be as broad or as stubborn about those beliefs as you want to be, if that somewhat makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah, it was very well said. And you said something there about the businesses that you work with to be willing to fail. And so let's kind of segue into this if we can. Struggles and, say, failures, as entrepreneurs, as human beings, obviously as business owners or parts of startups, one of our greatest struggles is the fear of being wrong, making total mistakes, and failing. Can you walk us through, since you want companies you work with to be willing to fail, can you walk us through how to fail?
I think it's based on kind of some core values or core principles of what you're looking to do. You know, I think there's kind of two sets of thought processes. There's telling companies you should be shooting or taking moonshots, going big or going home. And I don't know if that's necessarily true within large organizations or large enterprises because it's just not very feasible. Instead, it says willing to take incremental steps to get towards the moonshot and to take these incremental steps to try and approach new avenues or new opportunities. And so I think as part of that conversation of how do we get to failure quicker, because failure is more likely than success in reality. And so it's not about fail fast, fail cheap. It's about succeeding first time. And so you're trying to find a kind of a borderline between the two. And so with companies, it's generally putting ideas out there and saying, what can we try? What can we test? And also more importantly, how do we define success and how do we define failure? And what are the metrics that define success or failure? And I think, you know, you see that in a lot of startups where they're not doing well and they're not achieving the market saturation they expect and they're not achieving the growth they expect, but they can still always find some KPI or some number to stand behind that shows growth or the fact they're moving forward. And so I think the first thing for us companies is understanding what are our core goals that we're looking to achieve? You know, why do you want to even fail or succeed at something different? And why do you want to explore a new angle? And so it takes a fundamental want of the company to recognize what they don't know, or they know they don't know. Not to quote Donald Rumsfeld, I apologize. But I think but I think that's really important. And so that's a lot of what I'm doing now is talking to companies about the next 20, you know, the disruption's happening. And whether that's a keyword that gets thrown around too much or not, change is happening. And commerce is changing and it's happening very quickly. And you're seeing incumbents recognize that need to make fundamental changes in their organization, but they're large organizations. And so usually on my part, it starts with chairman's projects where let's just try something. Something small, see what happens. And very often the most amazing thing happens is that very senior people, especially within some of these chairman's projects, roll up their sleeves and are so excited to get on the whiteboard and talk about a great idea that perhaps they can't talk about or don't want to allocate resources of a specific team, but they might talk to an external small group about and say, try it, see what happens. You know, no harm, no foul.
Nice. And so it's one thing for a business to set up, like, say, its core values. And you say it's true. Everyone wants to, people want you to shoot for the moon, right? So especially once you get funding, right? People want to give you funding because they expect you to shoot for the moon. And that's what the money's for, typically. Is it not? How do you keep your core value of your startup that isn't shooting for the moon, but creating a stable, longer-term business that can cause a difference? When also taking on funding, where that funding really, the reason they gave it to you is because they're hoping for a huge payout.
But I think the reason they gave it to you is, yes, they're hoping for a huge payout, but they also recognize and believe in the core values that you've set out and the culture that you've set out and your founding or your foundational principles. So I think when a company does get investment, it's a personal relationship. They're giving someone the money. They're not giving the company the money. Yes, it goes into the company and it is company money, but they're giving someone, the person that sat across the table and pitched this idea in a couple of presentations, that's who's getting the money. And so in general, for the venture capitalist or the investor or the angel, it's seeing that person saying, this person not only has a great idea, but also has the chops to take it to the moon. And the way they're approaching this is in line with what I'm okay with. You know, moonshots are not bad. It's the question is how you get there, you know, and the answer is just not on a massive catapult.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. How do you define within a company or when a company is ready? Say you're consulting with them or it's your own company. How do you define when a company's ready or requires funding?
I think they require, you know, there's kind of two types of funding. There's the pre-traction funding, which is the funding required just to show that there's a viable product there that can be made and it has a certain degree of need in the marketplace, solves a specific pain point, disrupts a certain market, or enables certain disruption. I mean, those are kind of the foundational products that are coming out. So I think there's that pre-traction funding. And then there's the post-traction. It's when there's market need for this product and the scale is obvious. And I think for many companies, you can see that. It's they're starting to get the scale, the traction they're looking for. They're starting to get their first few customers. And now they have a choice. They can either continue this kind of slow grind where they can only scale X customers per period of time, or you give them money and again, hope it accelerates that sales pipeline. I mean, that's really what the money's for, sales pipeline.
Right, exactly. I guess I was looking maybe for what would you say defines a company that, like, where does it need to be able to scale to be viable for, say, funding? Say, either. I would say even post-traction, say. Like, I had Dan Martell on from Clarity, and I asked him this question. He was like, your company has to be able to foreseeably scale to $100 million in revenue. I wouldn't take a company to funding if they couldn't get to that part. And he's like, and I help companies, and I can get funding all day, he says. But to me, the company, you should be looking at finding customers rather than finding funding if you don't think you could foreseeably scale to $100 million in revenue.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point in terms of from, you know, Dan's perspective and from other perspectives. They all want to hear that B word. How are you going to get to a billion? How are you going to get to a billion? But the reality for a lot of startups, especially as they're in early stages of growth, is very often that product is going to be iterated on. There's going to be second, third, and fourth products that come down the line that actually take them to that billion-dollar market.
There we go.
So I don't think it is as cut and dry as you know, you've got to show me how you're going to get to that number. Is the market you're in, is there enough opportunity in that market to achieve that number? Because it's very often not going to be off that first product.
That's a smart way of looking at it. And I didn't think it was as cut and dry either. I expected more of an answer like you gave when he originally was just like, it has to go to this number. And I was like, wow, that was...
You know, I think for people that own the piggy bank, you know, they can set whatever rules they choose at the end of the day. It's their piggy bank. And I think what they're looking for is just, if it does scale and if it does get traction, if I do give you this money, are you going to be able to get bigger, quicker, better, faster, you know, iterate quicker, better, faster? And are you going to be able to do all those things that take you to that moonshot? So it's, yes, the number's important, obviously. They want that 20x, 50x return, and I get that. But I think they're also just looking for the person at the helm to be able to recognize opportunity and be able to pivot into that opportunity or be able to extend their product into the opportunity. You know, it's very tough as an early stage startup trying to tell people that you're going to be a $1 billion company and here's why. There's a section of, well, that's great. Why don't you be a $1 million company and then come back and talk to me?
Nice. Nice. I like that. Okay, let's move from, say, theoretical talking about startups to you and working within Enterprise Jungle at this point, if we can. We talked to your sister, your co-founder, and you are, I believe, the technical side of Enterprise Jungle, if I'm...
Yeah, I'm the technical and go-to-market. We conduct very different orchestras, but we share certain instruments. It's the way that, probably not as eloquent now I think about it, but that's essentially how you could describe our relationship, because we both have a very keen understanding of what each other can do and what our skill sets are and our capabilities are. And because we are brother and sister, we also understand the truth about what we don't like doing and what we don't want to do. And we know how to read lack of excitement. And we know how to read all those things that you can read within the same as on a Thanksgiving table. You can read your family very, very well. So we're able to recognize that. And therefore, by having very differing roles, we get to both do the roles that we want to do, we're excited to do, and we can succeed in. So that's been one of the real benefits of this relationship.
Nice. And she did explain to us like what you do in the company and what the parts you are good at. Can you maybe tell us something either that you don't like doing or that you are just terrible at in the business?
Wow, I kind of want to hear the list of things she said I was amazing at.
You'll have to listen.
Yeah. I was going to say, can you send me that as a follow-up so I can hold that forever? So I think in terms of what I don't enjoy doing or what I'm not fantastic at, one of the things that Emma is absolutely unbelievable at is expanding her network and providing great value to her network and maintain. She's one of the best at following up and really understanding the cycle of how personal relationships work. Mm-hmm. And I would say I'm not the greatest follower-upper and I'm not the greatest at maintaining those relationships. So I truly believe in the need to be proactive in building your network and proactive in having great connections so that as and when you need something or as and when there's an opportunity, you can go to the network you already have and go to that. And Emma's just been fantastic about that. And more importantly, somewhere that I'm just not amazing at is just these massive financial models that you have to do that she does. You know, to me, I've got, you know, 19 Excel windows open and I still can't get the answer. And she's working it all out on her iPhone. So she's got a very keen business and analytical mind. She's very good at contractual negotiations and she has great vision for the bigger term picture. So sometimes where I'm focused on just the next step on the ladder, she's very good at thinking about in context of not just tomorrow, but down the line. And it's not to say that I don't think about it. It's just something that I almost now don't have to be as concerned about because I know that's something that she's focused on. I can literally think about how we're going to move forward today. And so that's a great relationship there.
Nice. And yeah, she explained how she was very mathematical. I mean, she comes from finance and so she knows the numbers. And I like that you guys really seem to understand each other. I think that's probably key within the co-founder relationship. And obviously being siblings helps.
You can't really be at one with a co-partner or a co-founder until you've had enough blowout arguments. And people can say whatever they want, but as co-founders, you need to know what breaks people. And I don't mean break in the literal term, but you need to understand the load that you can put on someone else and what you can expect and what type of results you can expect. So when you understand the points of failure in a relationship, it's a lot easier to achieve success. And so for Emma and I, we know exactly what our capabilities are. She knows exactly what my breakpoints are, and she knows what the She knows what happens when I'm about to hit my breakpoint, so she can see it coming and vice versa. And breakpoint doesn't mean total collapse. It just means, you know, perhaps overload in certain areas or, you know, in a new area where a little bit unqualified to be focused on. And so being able to recognize failure or potential failure before it happens is a phenomenal opportunity. And I say that for all co-founders is, you know, have you had your first massive fight? And if you have, what happened afterwards? Did you go for pizza and hug it out? Or did you not talk to each other for 3 days? You know, and I think it's important to recognize that. You can't really understand what success looks like until you know what failure looks like.
Yeah. Have you had, I guess you've had co-founders before?
I have, good and bad.
Have you? Yeah. Okay. So have you, how would you pick, say, how would you figure out ahead of time before going into obviously a full-on co-founder relationship with somebody and know what that blow up and if you can have pizza after, or if you're going to, obviously with your sister, you have a relationship beforehand, you know this. Absolutely. How would you do that now? Do you know, like,
so I think
what kind of test you would run on that?
So I think there's two things when I think about a co-founder now. And when we think about partners, it's, you know, there's a couple of critical things. It's number one is, do I think I could do their job? And I'm looking for partners where the answer is categorically no, because it means I understand what their success looks like and they understand what mine is. And I don't mean in terms of delegation. I mean in terms of, do they bring a specific skill set to the table that I don't hold? So in terms of trying to identify what that blow up, what those failure points look like, oftentimes when people, you know, when I do some of these mentor sessions and, you know, we've got Silicon Beach in Los Angeles or any of the other keywords that people like to call it. And I often meet co-founders and those are questions that I always ask, which is, you know, what is your co-founder really bad at? What does he hate? You know, what does he not enjoy doing? And if you don't know that, it's very difficult to say that you've got a real co-founder because it might not scale, which is why a lot of startups, that original foundational team doesn't end up being the team that grows with it, because the startup grows out of some of the relationships as more and more is found out about every party in there. You know, it's all good at the beginning when everyone's got passion and motivation and excitement and startup and Red Bull and pizza and all of those things. But what about when everything turns? What about that when you have self-doubt about whether you've actually got a good idea or not? What about when the third customer in a row says no? You know, what happens when it's just not a good time? You know, when that gray cloud is just sitting atop your head? That's really important to identify. And it's going to be really important to know the people that can truck through that and can see the sunshine.
Yeah. Yeah, it really, really, really is. And I think it's key. I wish there was a way we could figure that way, way out beforehand. But sometimes you really got to be in the trenches to know. You can't just isolate those things and you can't run a test to see what happens when the first 10 customers tell you no and you need that money in the bank to continue growing, right?
But I do think that the more people you meet, and going back to my side gig conversation of that thirst for knowledge, that always moving forward, the more people you interact with, the more people you speak to, the more you recognize the type of person that you get on with and you can work with and you can have a successful relationship with. So I also think that's a product of experience, both good and bad.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Okay, so for a side gig or just say a project, something that you would go to take on, the way you're out there consulting now, you've had a lot of business experience. You guys are out there writing, speaking, doing all kinds of stuff. You probably get either pitched or just ideas or potential partnerships or deals or things that you could partake in. How would you go about now something coming through your inbox or across your desk and choosing whether it's something that you, James, would either like to take on and it's something that we could run with within Enterprise Jungle, or separately, as in this could be another side gig and something that might interest me or be of value to me?
So I think there's kind of two answers. Number one is, I think the greatest lesson I've probably learned with my experience is the fact I'm not as busy as I think I am. And I think that's, you know, that was a big lesson for me to understand personally and to get to grips with personally, is that if you want to make time, you can make time. And if you don't want to make time, you're too busy. And it's a conscious decision. And I think we, especially in our, you know, infancy of early business, we're too busy for everything and everybody and anything, unless it's focused around us and how we can succeed. And unless it's totally narcissistic on helping us, we're not really interested. And I think the more you grow as a leader, as a principal of a company, as just a person, and you start to think about you know, my legacy and all of those other conversations that we spoke about, it's you start to realize you can make time. And so when opportunities come across my desk, they really fall into one of three categories. Number one, does this constitute an opportunity for me where I can learn something because I have an insane thirst for knowledge? And I think that's a critical, critical component of any startup founder. And so am I going to learn something from it? Am I going to get something from it? And if so, what is the expectation of time? And does that work for me in terms of can I actually make the amount of time they're looking for? So that's one. The second is when I look at talking to startups or talking to groups of startups. And I did one yesterday that was fantastic to about 40 startups talking about why they should focus on the enterprise market versus the consumer market. And the reason I took that was twofold. One is I wanted to speak to incredibly brilliant minds and I knew that room would be full of them. Two is you never know what opportunities for collaboration will come out of it. And most important is I had mentors, I had people that help us. You know, a lot of our success can be attributed to the people that wanted to see us succeed. And I think that's really important. And so I want to see others succeed. I want to see great concepts succeed. And so I'm happy to get involved where I can, where I see the potential for success and I see the people that have all the elements that they should be able to get to success. But most of all, I'm always curious. And so I take a lot of things that perhaps, you know, it never hurts to take 20 minutes on the phone.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that I can do that all day, every day, but I'm also not suggesting that I'm important enough to get enough requests to be on the phone for 20 minutes every day. But, you know, if there's something that resonates, why not explore? It's people have an amazing knack to surprise you.
Yeah.
And I think people forget that every now and again.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully, fully agree. And something I've started doing a lot more of, every email that comes through from listeners or anything, it's just, I'm more than willing to respond to them fully there. And then if somebody says, do you have 10 minutes on Skype? Yes, I do. Or 15 minutes. By all means, because you do. And I'm blown away sometimes by the things I hear. And by the people that want advice from me, it's just like, really? I think I should be asking you for advice, but it's great.
I was on a call yesterday with a startup out of Germany working on a fantastic technology for large enterprise and fitness and how that affects operational efficiency and performance. And they rang me for some advice. And after they just introduced themselves and they spoke, and more they spoke, I realized that actually I was getting the most benefit out of this because I was unfamiliar with that market. I didn't recognize, you know, we all know that obviously a healthier and a fitter, you know, employee is going to perform better. But I didn't realize some of the numbers and I didn't realize how you can track that. And so I came out of that call. And so they gave me insight into a market, which is tremendous knowledge. And in the same realm, I gave them insight into how they may want to approach the market. So really, a great side gig per se is one where there's a very harmonious relationship. It's got to be two-way. Must be.
Yeah, exactly. All right, James, let's move to success in the future for you and for Enterprise Jungle. We have a new year approaching quickly. Can you tell us what it is you want to accomplish next year as a business and as a person? And like, what are your goals for the following year, coming year?
Wow, I wish I'd prepped for this call. So, and you were so kind to email me the question.
It's the first week in December. You're supposed to be prepped for next year.
Crap, I never knew that. Okay. So, you know, I think that I don't look at the calendar so much in terms of the new year for our business. I think one of the big parts for us as a business is always move forward. So we set these incredible goals. I mean, one of the goals we set probably 9 months ago was that when we launched our product, we wanted to be on stage with the president of platform solutions of SAP, introducing our product and demoing it to SAP customers. And that was just a goal we saw because we watched his keynote, you know, 8 months prior. And we were like, this guy is fantastic. This is a guy we want to share a stage with. And this is the stage we need to launch on because these are our customers sitting in the audience. So we had this very lofty goal. And so really every day is about moving one step closer to achieving the goal. I'm really thinking about what it's going to take to achieve it. So I think when we talk about what do we want going into the new year, it's I think we want to continue the path we're on, which is always moving forward, always be willing to error correct ourselves, always be willing to iterate slightly, and always being absolutely laser focused in what we're trying to achieve and what we're trying to solve and making sure that, you know, some of the noise doesn't affect us. You know, we've done very good thus far of kind of isolating our vision and being very specific about it. But as more opportunities present themselves, it's very easy to diversify your views. You know, when a big customer comes forward and says, hey, can your product do this? And you want that couple of customers. So you end up saying yes, or you end up doing No one does free work like a startup to get a big customer. It's just no one does it. And so it's really important as we're going into our first few customers, which is what we're doing now. We're now going into our first three customers. And it's really important for us to recognize that we have value and what our value is, and to make sure that we represent that to the customers we're going into, so we can have a, you know, a great relationship that hopefully lasts many, many years. And I think the second thing is recognizing that as a company, it's time for us to bring on some other fantastic people who have incredible domain expertise in areas where we perhaps lack. It's not that we're unwilling or we can't do it. It's there's better people to do it. And so for us, Emma and I have always been very, very clear that when we bring people on, we're bringing them on to a stable environment where we want to bring the best of the best. And so while some startups, you know, just want to hire everyone out the gate, even when it's in concept stage, Emma and I never had that idea. It was always, we should be able to do a majority of the work ourselves and have some allies we work with, you know, but you don't ask someone to leave a fantastic job doing amazing things to come work for an idea. You ask them to come work for an opportunity and for some stability, which is, I think, a critically important part of hiring in an early stage company.
Nice. I've never thought about it that way. And that makes perfect sense. And now this coming year will hopefully bring that for you.
I hope so.
Excellent. James, thank you so much. We've talked a lot about you. We've talked a lot about your business. Can you just leave everyone and tell them where they can go find out more about you?
So enterprisejungle.com to find out more about our business. And then I'm relatively active on the Twitters, and I'm at JDS_again. You know, I love to hear what people are doing. I love to see what people are doing. I love to try out new stuff. And in the same way, I hope you guys will have a look at what we're doing.
Excellent. I will link to your Twitter and Enterprise Jungle on the show notes for everyone to find you easily. So thank you so much, James, and I wish you amazing things in the coming future.
Thank you, John. What an opportunity. And I really appreciate the opportunity to think about what my goals are for 2015. I'll start doing that now.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
You too. James, thank you so much for the brilliant conversation. I love it. And thank you for being the first in the co-founder series. It was actually kind of brought to my attention that I should do this by you and your sister, and I just appreciate it. It's great. It's a great, great, great idea. And I'm very happy that we decided to do it. Good conversation. But there was one thing, wasn't there? There always seems to be one thing. Did you do it? Did you find it? Did you get it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
If you want to make time, you can make time. And if you don't want to make time, you're too busy. And it's a conscious decision. And I think we, especially in our, you know, infancy of early business, we're too busy for everything and everybody and anything, unless it's focused around us and how we can succeed. And unless it's totally narcissistic on helping us, we're not really interested.
And that's the hack. Beautifully, beautifully said, James. And I totally agree. This is something I've only realized in, I'll say, the past year, but the past 6 months for absolute for real, which is you aren't too busy. If you say you're too busy, it's because you don't want to do it. And you have to pay attention to other people. You have to be willing to help other people. You have to be willing to do things that aren't just selfishly for you. The more you give to other people, the more you help other people, the more you reach out and are just willing to give your time, your effort, your brilliance to other people, the more of everything that will come back to you. And I don't mean in some just weird, like the secret type way at all. I just mean you just get out there more and people are more willing, obviously, to help you and to do things if you've taken the step to help them with no just thoughts of, well, what can they do for me? That's absolutely wrong. You need to just be willing to help people as much as you can. And if you think you're too busy, it's because you're just saying you're too busy, and it's because you don't actually want to do it. And you need to flip that around. I absolutely, absolutely believe that. And thank you, James. Again, this has been so much fun. I just appreciate that you're out there listening. This is just, it's awesome. It makes me very happy. HackTheEntrepreneur.com is my website. Please stop by, leave a comment on James's episode if you wish, and get on the email list, and you'll get my email every Sunday. I don't know, my best hacks that I've come up with and we'll just be able to have a conversation. I'm taking James's lead and saying I am available. You get on that email list and you reply to even the welcome email. Ask me any questions you want. I'm there for you to help in any way that I possibly can. The emails come straight to my phone. So wherever I am, I can respond to you and I would love to help you out. So please go check it out, hackentrepreneur.com. And until next time, please keep hacking the entrepreneur.